The Guardian.
My feeling is that we've probably given more than we've got out of the EU. I'm not sure what we've really benefited.
I would say it probably is. I think its days are probably numbered. I'd prefer to see Britain out, to be honest.
The Eurostar rail terminal here in central London is a gateway to the continent. You can trade in your pounds for euros and be in Brussels in under 2 hours. But despite the cultural links, the transport and the ease of modern communications, Britain remains in many ways distant from Europe, especially from its government in the Belgian capital. A recent poll showed almost half of Britons, 49%, would vote to leave the European Union completely if given the option in a referendum. And so-called Euroscepticism is on the rise across the continent too.
I will say that just as Thatcher said a long time ago, I want my money back before this, because I can pay the debt, but I want something back in the changing of policy, economic policy in Europe, I think.
It's a point highlighted by the Eurosceptic think tank, Open Europe. Its Danish director is Mats Persson.
The idea of a federal Europe, I believe, is very much dead at the moment, apart from perhaps in a few places in Brussels itself, where you have, let's call it, a few pockets of resistance. But when it comes to public opinion across Europe, the trend is clear. People do not want more EU integration, and in most cases they want to reverse European integration and have Europe do less. Now, the most interesting example there is Germany, and there was a poll from last year, one of the European Commission's own polls, which showed that the share of people in Germany that thought that the EU was a good thing had dropped by 10 percentage points in only 1 year. I mean, that's a massive drop in support for the European Union. These kind of trends we see in Germany and we see it in other places across Europe as well.
For some on the Eurosceptic right, the crisis represents a vindication. Douglas Carswell is a long-time conservative Eurosceptic trying to resist that most European-sounding emotion, Schadenfreude.
No one should be saying, "I told you so," in order to prove that they were right all along. The reason why I'm saying "we told you so" is to try to ensure that our governments don't keep repeating the same mistakes.
Carswell has become a poster boy for many of the new intake Conservative MPs, among them Dominic Raab. He's one of a group of Tories set to form a Eurosceptic parliamentary pressure group.
I don't think Britain should hold the Eurozone hostage. Although some people will say that's the main lever or the main leverage we've got. I don't think that's sensible at all, because we'll just be blamed for everything that goes wrong. But what I think we need to do is set out a positive blueprint. And I mean, ultimately, at some point, we ought to have a mandate for that. And that will bring into question at some point whether we need a referendum. But I think you see a lot of Euro-realists in the 2010 intake, certainly Conservative MPs, but they're a diverse bunch. My father was a refugee from the Czechoslovakia. I've lived, studied, travelled, worked in a number of different European countries, and I certainly don't see myself as hostile to Europe or Europeans. But what I do think we need to look at is the democratic architecture within which we, Britain, drive economic reforms and drive economic competitiveness, as well as control over other things like our justice system, which people in this country are rightly proud of.
But the history of Euroscepticism is not a straightforward one. It was the Conservative Party who enthusiastically led Britain into the European Economic Community in the 1970s.
We have all come to recognise our common European heritage, our mutual interests, and our European destiny.
Before Margaret Thatcher led the Eurosceptic charge against Brussels a decade later.
We have not successfully rolled back the frontiers of the state in Britain, only to see them reimposed at a European level, with a European superstate exercising a new dominance from Brussels.
Thatcher viewed the European project, embodied by President Jacques Delors, as an attempt to impose costly social policies on Britain. The right-wing press mirrored her increasingly hostile attitude to Brussels, culminating in one of the most famous tabloid headlines of all time. On the 1st of November 1990, the Sun splashed with a two-finger gesture next to the headline, "Up yours, Delors." Eurosceptic Tory mayor Boris Johnson was covering Brussels at the time as a journalist.
I was working as a reporter in Brussels and I saw this thing. I suddenly realised that the European debate in Britain had really gone critical and it had reached suddenly a much wider audience. And a subject that had once been completely tedious in the eyes of the electorate was now becoming electoral dynamite.
Little more than a year later, though, the Maastricht Treaty was signed by the continent's presidents and prime ministers, leading to the creation of the European Union. Crucially, it set the groundwork for a single European currency, the euro. When French-speaking Europhile Tony Blair took office in 1997, it was Labour policy to make preparations to join the newly created currency. His longest-serving Europe minister was the fervently pro-EU Dennis McShane. I asked him how difficult it is now to make a case for a progressive, integrated Europe.
It's so much easier to play the anti-European card. President Sarkozy's done it. He has been lambasting the European Central Bank in recent years. German politicians are doing it all the time. We sometimes think in Britain we're the champion of Euroscepticism with a very virulent Eurosceptic press and politicians. And don't forget, most of the Labour MPs and senior people were very Eurosceptic in the 1980s when Mrs. Thatcher was rather keen on Europe. But I go to other countries and I see a lot of raw Euroscepticism because it's no better way of getting a cheer than to blame it on the faceless bureaucrats of Brussels. Believe me, it doesn't matter what language you use the rhetoric in, it gets a rousing cheer, but there's a price to be paid because then if nobody believes in Europe, then Europe isn't going to exist. And I think the disaggregation, the breakup of the European Union, the return of individual currencies, frontier controls, trade controls, and so on, would be disastrous, certainly for Britain and for all of the different countries in Europe.
Here at The Guardian, where the line from the paper's leader columns was in favour of Britain's greater involvement in the EU's affairs, a note of caution was sounded in the run-up to a decision on the single European currency.
A policy of standing on the sidelines while encouraging preparation for monetary union in Britain is a good and necessary each-way bet.
Among the journalists, though, there was no such consensus on what was being called the most important economic issue of the time. The Guardian produced a short book, published in 1997, on the debate over entry to the single currency. The paper's European editor, John Palmer, believed globalisation meant creating the euro was essential.
By requiring national states to share more of their economic sovereignty, European Monetary Union can, I believe, restore to EU governments collectively greater influence over economic developments than they can ever exercise alone.
But the economics editor, Larry Elliott, was firmly against it.
Monetary union is rotten politics, but the reason it's rotten politics is that it is rotten economics.
And even the more instinctively pro-European columnist Martin Kettle was concerned. Well, Larry, Martin and John are all here with me now. John, were you right?
I always took the view, which more importantly was expressed by Jacques Delors, that monetary union to be sustained would require economic and political union, indeed I say also a social union. But nonetheless, for 10 years, perhaps amazingly, the monetary union as a single pillar existed and largely succeeded. And I think what we're seeing now is the reality that to survive, the other pillars of the process that Delors urged unsuccessfully on governments will now have to be taken.
Larry, was it the absence of that kind of much broader framework, what you meant when you said that monetary union was rotten politics?
I had three main problems with monetary union. The first was that I didn't think the countries that were going to go into it could rub along together. I didn't think they were of a similar economic state of development. I thought they would struggle to rub along together, and that's proved to be true. The second design fault, I thought, with the euro, was there was no real flexibility. If there was a bad thing happening, if there was what's known as an economic shock, then the mechanism for countries to get out of it was not there. That there was no real labour market mobility, there was no system of fiscal transfers, of moving money from rich parts to poor parts of the union, as there is inside the UK or inside the US. And as a result, the third thing that would happen would be the ordinary working people would suffer from this, that actually it would be a deflationary mechanism, and the real victims of this would be the poor, the weak, the unemployed. And I think all those three things have come true.
Martin, you talked about the Maastricht Treaty being, you know, perhaps coming to be seen as damaging as Versailles. What was damaging about Versailles in the end was the kind of complete rigidity with which it was enforced, the kind of complete lack of any kind of flexibility to reflect what was happening. And is that really what you considered was the weakness of Maastricht?
Well, I looked at Maastricht, I think, with a combination of John Palmer's heart and Larry Elliott's head. I personally was in favour of a greater European Union and of the single currency if it could be made to work. But I think for it to be made to work, it had to have either a less ambitious political remit than it did have. And I also thought that, and I still think, that it is a tremendous political ask for any British government to get involved in that. Now, that's pretty much off the table for the foreseeable future now, but it was on the table all those years ago when we were talking about it. And the question of whether the UK became part of the Eurozone was quite a serious question. I mean, you know, Tony Blair at one point, even in government, said that it was Britain, you know, Britain had a destiny there. And he, you know, and as we now have had confirmed, was very, very keen to join the single currency. Now, I mean, a lot has changed since then, but I still think that Britain is not an instinctively pro-EU country in its heart. And I'm sad about that, but it's a fact.
I think the question that's going to be about at party conferences really is what the impact of the euro's troubles is on the politics of Europe, and particularly on the kind of rise of Euroscepticism. And we're already seeing the Tories shaping up, the new Tories, to be a thoroughly organised group of Eurosceptics. Martin, do you think that's going to become an increasingly large factor in British politics over the next 3 years?
There's a lot of pressure in the Tory party, as there always has been over the last 20, 30 years, for Europe to be their defining issue. Now, to a lot of Tories, that issue is an in-out referendum on the European Union. But that is not, I think, ultimately where the Tory party hierarchy is going to want to go.
Larry.
Yeah, if monetary union, I mean, there must be some Tories who think it would be great for monetary union to collapse, but actually that would be completely disastrous for the UK economy, and not only in the short term, but in the medium term. I mean, it would cause a huge shock to the global economy, be like Lehman Brothers, except even worse if the European Union, if monetary union was to break up. The shockwaves of that would be absolutely enormous. And already the Bank of England, people there are talking about monetary union and the problems of the Eurozone being the biggest threat to the economy. So, you know, the idea that, that anybody in the government would actually wish this thing to happen, I think, is kind of a bit fanciful. And it's interesting that George Osborne, who's by no means a big fan of the euro, is himself talking about Europe needing to take the steps that are now needed to actually make monetary union work properly. And that does actually, you know, the reality is it does actually mean going further down the road towards European integration and further down the road towards political union, because that is the only way you are going to actually dig some decent foundations for this.
I agree with Larry about that. I think what Osborne and the other leaders are saying, that the euro area needs to move faster and more determinedly towards an economic and fiscal union, is sending out a rather discouraging message to the hard-line Eurosceptics in the rank and file, some of whom I've heard already complaining that the pass has been sold. Britons cannot disengage very easily from this process, and the Europeans can't backtrack, or if they do backtrack, it'll be at massively greater cost to all concerned. The only way is forward.
And I suppose one thought perhaps in Osborne's head, Martin, is that greater economic and social union in the Eurozone leaves Britain more outside, more kind of defensively outside than previously.
Well, that's the argument that he would put, I think. And the problem, I think, as always in the Tory party, is that there is a very vocal minority, sometimes larger, sometimes smaller, which is, you know, which is very much in cahoots with quite a large part of the media. The person you have to watch in all this is Boris Johnson. I think if Boris Johnson wins the mayoralty of London again next year, then he'll be preoccupied with that. If he's a loose cannon in the Tory party as a defeated mayoral candidate, beaten by Ken Livingstone, then I think his instinct will be to put himself at the head of those forces, and that would be a very interesting phenomenon, I think.
This is going to be a big issue at party conferences, despite David Cameron's efforts to keep the lid on a question that could wreck the coalition. Yet though Conservative MPs are still reluctant to be labelled as Eurosceptic troublemakers, they may find that they have more support among the Tory leadership than many suppose. Tim Montgomery edits the Conservative Home website.
I think there is a lot of suspicion that this new Eurosceptic grouping is not as independent of the Tory leadership as perhaps some would want us to believe. Certainly one of the three principal founders of the group, George Eustace, is a former press secretary to David Cameron and has remained very close to him ever since. And there is a pattern at the moment in the Conservative Party of a number of groups emerging. This one and a so-called group of 40 of Tory MPs in marginal seats that it is suspected are being promoted by the Tory leadership and the Whip's office as alternatives to some of the conventional right-wing groups. I think certainly his advisers, including Steve Hilton and Oliver Letwin, have become much more Eurosceptic since entering Downing Street. They've become incredibly aware how much the European Union bureaucracy frustrates things that they want to do. Steve Hilton, Cameron's key advisor, has calculated that 30% of all the paperwork they deal with comes from the European Union. There are divergent views on whether David Cameron has become more Eurosceptic. He has certainly had some of the same experiences. But there is also this phenomenon that happens when a prime minister enters the company of other heads of government, and he's become quite close to Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy, and that influences him, and I think he quite enjoys being part of that club.
One thing both Euro enthusiasts and Eurosceptics alike can agree on is that we're approaching a fork in the road. One way lies a closer, more integrated union of the kind Jacques Delors dreamt of in the 1980s. The other way could lie a breakup of the currency and an end, for now at least, to any notion of a federal Europe. Tory backbencher Douglas Carswell again.
As we discovered, as the Tory government discovered in the early 1990s, eventually if you ignore economic reality, it kind of becomes a little bit difficult to keep fudging things. And Europe is fast approaching the moment where I just don't think it can really fudge facts anymore. Now, 2 + 2 is never going to equal 5.
The Eurostars will continue to speed under the channel to the continent, but the future of European politics, its currency, and its austerity-pinched people cannot be so easily timetabled. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anne Perkins. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.